Okay, so last week we spoke about Yaakov's feelings towards Leah.
Mm-hmm.
And his feelings towards Rachel we really don't need to really speak about because the Torah tells us pretty straight out what his feelings were towards Rachel. However, I'd like to ask your feelings towards Rachel, sort of. I'd like you to look at the psukim where she's introduced, possibly. We're on page 140. If you want to look at the English, 147, 149, 151. Perek Chaset, the 29th chapter of Bereishit, where Rachel is introduced, plus whatever knowledge you have in your mind of previous experience and exposure to Rachel. And I'd like you to tell me about Rachel. We have a lot of things that she does, but we don't have a lot of descriptions of what she's like. What qualities does Rachel have? So you can look through it and just jot a few ideas down that you have, and then we'll move forward from there.
Then they become best friends.
How do you know they become best friends?
Because Leah, after three sons, she stopped to having babies, and when she gives the slaves to her husband...
After four sons.
Yeah.
Right.
And then she prayed hard.
Who prayed hard?
Zaleah. And she asked God, maybe her husband gonna love her more.
Right.
You know, and she had again son three times.
Uh-huh.
And then...
So what does this tell us about Rachel, about qualities that Rachel might have, characteristics, her personality?
She is very kind. She is a very good woman.
Okay. How is she kind?
To her sister. She was very too kind.
How?
Jealous. I don't know how to...
Because I'm saying, like, not necessarily just because Leah had four sons first, you know, that doesn't show that Rachel was kind to her necessarily. I mean, according to the Midrash that we spoke about last week with Rachel giving over the secret code, then that was an unbelievably selfless and kind thing for Rachel to do. But otherwise, I'm not sure. I don't know how, if you get kind, she might have been a kind person, but I don't know how you see that from her actions necessarily. I'm wondering how she was kind to Leah. Next week, well, I don't know, next week or 2 weeks, we'll discuss the their relationship, Rachel's, and next week, and for the next 2 weeks, last week and this week we were speaking about Yaakov's relationships with his wives, and the next 2 weeks we'll discuss their relationships to each other. Mm-hmm. So we'll see if you think the same or differently afterwards. But what other things do we think about Rachel? What other qualities?
She had a lot of envy, actually.
Envy?
Of her sister and even the, the concubines. Because they all were able to produce sons. And she, wanted, when Leah's son brought her, was it mandrakes?
Okay.
Flowers. She begged her for them and even offered up her night with her husband to get it. So I'm not sure that was a kindness. I think she had extreme kindness at the wedding, you know, from that beginning. But I think later it was more of a, okay, I want these fine sons too.
Okay. So envy, determination, yeah.
I have a hard time seeing the wedding as kindness.
Elaborate, please.
I just think that it was really deceitful on her part.
To what gain?
I just
But if you're going to bring deceit into the picture, which some deceit certainly exists, when you bring deceit into the picture, it has to be for a reason. Because otherwise, what's her purpose? Otherwise, it's not an intentional deceit. If you're saying
deceit,
that it's intentional.
The deceit was, on one hand, it seems like a kindness to Leah, but on the other hand, it's a deceit to Yaakov.
Okay.
Yaakov, who she's supposed to love.
Okay.
Is that the way to start out a marriage?
So what should she have done?
I think she should have told him.
Told
him the truth.
When?
Before the wedding.
she didn't have opportunity to.
She had opportunity to teach the signals with her hands
to Leah, but she might not have had any opportunity to be together with Yaakov.
She could have gotten a message.
How? By all her servants who Laban gave her, who could all be have allegiance to Laban himself?
I just don't see it as being right.
It might not be right, what she did, but I think I'd like to propose, one of the things that we spoke about last week a little bit, was that she had no choice. She might have had no choice in the matter. And her action was either hurting both of them or hurting one of them. And she chose, which could be, you know, what you're saying, Hannah, about how kind she was to each other. At the end of the day, no matter what envy, what resentment they have between the two of them, Rachel and Leah are still sisters. Do you have a sister?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. At the end of the day, as much as sisters could be the nastiest to each other, nastier than nasty to each other, at the end of the day, bottom line, blood is thicker than water, which I think is what's shown here in this Rachel and Leah episode. It's interesting to discuss what their relationship is to each other, which we'll start that next week a little bit. But so far we have that Rachel is possibly a little bit deceitful. She's determined. She will do, let's say, whatever needs to be done in order to attain the goal that she wants, let's say. Her goal being either to save Leah for embarrassment. She's willing to risk Yaakov, even though she got him in the end. You know, it could be she had such faith in him that he would fight for her and she would be able to be with him, that she was able to give
that
up.
Then why didn't she have a lot of faith that God would give her...
No, she has faith in Yaakov.
Right, but then why didn't she have... If she had that much faith in Yaakov, why didn't she have that kind of faith when it comes down to having children?
Why faith in God. So you're asking her to transmit her faith in a person to her faith in God.
That should be stronger, right?
You would think so.
With someone like her, you would think so.
You would hope so. Right. But so we're going to discuss that. So you have to come back 2 weeks from now. I mean, next week also. Next week we're going to, in my mind, they see that next week we'll talk about the Duda in these mandrakes that Leah had, which will lead us a little bit, we might skip ahead a little bit, talk about Dina. Similar kind of situation between Leah and Dina. Dina gets into some trouble with Shem. And then we'll go back the week after. We'll talk about Rachel and Yaakov, and she gives her maid servant to Yaakov as a solution. And what was her complaint? What was her claim? What was her issue with it? Did she not have faith in God? Did she not have faith in Yaakov? Had she gone to every possible fertility doctor within 1,000 miles? And, you know, she was just frustrated. So we'll talk about that a couple weeks from now, but her faith in God is an interesting question. Yeah.
But isn't it safe to say that all the matriarchs and the patriarchs are all spiritual prophets, and they had fulfilled the Torah before it was given, so they had to have some type of idea that this was supposed to happen.
That what was supposed to happen?
That she would forfeit her marriage for her sister.
Okay. She didn't forfeit it. She got it in the end.
She got it in the end, but she, you know, she could have came second.
Right. Okay. So first of all, in terms of if the forefathers and if all of them kept the Torah beforehand, I am personally of the opinion that they didn't necessarily keep the mitzvot, but they kept what the Torah was all about,
right,
which are the morals that this world was actually created for. You know, that the Midrash tells us that God looked in the Torah and then created the world. So the world has certain inherent morals in it that society sometimes tries to fight against and create their own morals, but that the Avot and Imahot understood this and they understood what the proper and correct morals were. Were they spiritual people in terms of did they see in advance? We'd like to think so, but at the same time they're also real, very real regular people with real emotions.
Yes.
So I'd like to try to focus on that part a little bit, on the real part of it, because I think that it's easier for us to relate to. We started off in the very beginning of the class a few weeks ago speaking about, like, putting them up on a pedestal, how they're perfect and they're wonderful and they're complete beings and spiritual and complete beings and they're physical and everything, complete, total creations. And now we're trying to see, okay, now how can I relate to that? now and to try to see a little bit some more of the human side. Although tonight we're going to go a little bit more into the spiritual side also, and we're going to present that a little bit. So what spiritual qualities, let's say, did Rachel have? We said she's positively deceitful, she's very determined, she might have some envy, she'll do whatever she wants to attain her goal. Are her goals lofty goals? Are they selfish goals? Are they selfless goals? What do you think about her?
Selfish.
Her goal is to?
For herself, selfish.
Which is what? Which is her selfish goal?
Because she always think about herself.
How? What does she want for herself?
You see, when she can have a child.
Okay.
She was very jealous of her sister
Natalie.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. And give
or afraid.
Or afraid.
Jealous or afraid of losing her husband's affection because the sister's having more children.
Okay, I hear you. Yeah.
Yeah, and she gave her slave to the
right.
husband.
So her selfish goal was to have a child.
Yes, and she
just
had
for herself. She wanted it,
yes.
And she put, and in the end, she died for it because she died when she had her second child. She died when she had Binyamin. Okay. Great. Let's get into some of the sources that I prepared for tonight about Rachel, and then we'll go back to Leah also, because Rachel and Leah are working somewhat together. At least between the two of them, plus their maidservants, they do in the end come up with the 12 tribes of Israel. So there's some kind of symbiosis going on there, some kind of working together. Yaakov first leaves his parents' home at the end, the first time our pre-Rachel Leah story is at the end of the previous parasha. Yaakov leaves his house at the command of his mother and then at the command of his father, and they both tell him to go back to the mother's birthplace and to find a wife. There are two purposes to his leaving his parents' household. What are those two reasons that he has for leaving his parents' household?
One is to escape his brother.
Yes. And the other?
To prevent his father from losing his son.
Okay, but that's the same as the first one.
To seek a wife.
Exactly. There's both the avoidance of the negative and the pursuance of the positive. He's trying to avoid being killed by his brother, and thereby having his father lose both sons in one day. And in addition, he's supposed to search for a wife to not only prevent his father from losing a son, but to actually encourage the further generations and the continuing of his father's name, and more importantly, of his father's legacy that he has passed on to him. So we have these two aspects. So he comes to, he gets to Haran, he gets to the house in, to the area where Laban lives, and in the initial meeting, I don't know what you call it, like in a play, what's it called in a play, the first time you see a character? Okay, the first time you see a character in a play, you know, character shows up on the scene. Immediately, you have certain cues that you can get about the person, right? The way they're dressed, the way they look, the way they carry themselves, what they have in their hands, the surroundings where the person is found. You immediately can make assumptions about that character, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Incorrect? Okay, fine. So let's look at that first time. What's happening the first time when she shows up? We're on page 147, 149, the beginning of chapter 29. Jacob lifts his feet, goes towards the land of the Easterners. He looked, and behold, a well in the field. And behold, three flocks of sheep lay there beside it. From that well they would water the flocks, and the stone over the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks would be assembled, there they would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep. Then they would put back the stone over the mouth of the well in its place. And Jacob says to them, "Where are you from?" They said, "We're from Haran." And he said, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" And they said, "Yeah." And he said, "Is it well with him?" And they said, "It is well." In the Hebrew, they say, "Hashalom." He says, "Hashalom." They say, "Shalom." Vihine Rachel bito ba'aim hatzom. Here is Rachel, his daughter, coming with the sheep. So immediately, we have, what do we know about Rachel?
She's Laban's daughter.
She's a shepherdess. And what's the atmosphere, the surrounding thing that's going on here at the same time? Where are they located?
Near a well.
Okay, so we have the water, we have Rachel being the daughter of Laban, and we have that she is a shepherdess. And indeed, in a few psukim later, this is focused on in Pasuk 10, verse 9, Odenu medaberim am, he's still speaking with him, v'Rachel ba'ayim hatzon asher la'aviha. Rachel is coming with the sheep that belongs to her father. ki ro'ahi, because she is a shepherdess. This is something that we learn about that, you know, the Torah doesn't mince words. The Torah doesn't, sorry, use extra words. So really, if she's coming with a sheep, okay, like, hello, obviously she's a shepherdess. What's the point of the Torah telling us that she's a shepherdess? Ro'ahi?
Because what do you think? Everyone else was shepherds and they would take care of the people.
Okay.
The Jewish nation. So she knew how to
Who else was shepherds? Moshe was shepherd, but he wasn't until later on.
Right.
Abraham and Yitzchak weren't shepherds. They had shepherds who worked for them.
Does this have anything to do with her being one of the mothers?
Very possibly. And this is a quality that she had of leadership. When you're a shepherd, you're leading the flock. You're keeping them together, mm-hmm. keeping them contained, keeping them on the right path. Right away we know that she is a leader. And what else do we know about her? Her name, Rachel. The name Rachel means a young sheep. She's quiet. She's unassuming. She may be determined, as we'll find out later on, but she's usually working behind the scenes. She's very, as we would say, tenua. She's a very modest woman, keeping behind the scenes. But at the same time, she is, the Torah makes a point to tell us that she's a ro'ah, that she is a shepherdess. She is leading the sheep. So she has these two qualities of modesty and also of leadership, that she's leading them. Right away, we see that from the start. What does he notice? What does Yaakov notice? She's coming. Vayehi, Pasuk Yud, chapter 10, verse 10, Vayehi kasher ra'a Yaakov et Rachel bat Lavan achi imo. When Yaakov saw Rachel, the daughter of Lavan, his mother's brother, ve'etshon Lavan achi imo, and the sheep of Lavan, his mother's brother, vayigash Yaakov, Yaakov approached. Vayagel et ha'eben me'al piha be'er, with Herculean efforts, he removed this huge stone on top of the well. Vayashk etshon Lavan achi imo, and he gave drink to the cattle and the sheep of Lavan, his mother's brother. What do we hear? See here, this is like reading between the lines a little bit, but just a little bit. What do we see here? What's Yaakov's immediate impression of Rachel?
She's beautiful.
No, in Pasuk Yud, right in chapter, in verse 10. It doesn't say anything about what she looks like even.
He kissed her.
Before then, what's his impression? Right here in verse 10, in the verse I just read, the Torah is telling us what his impression is of her, what he thinks of it. And it was when Yaakov saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Yaakov came forward, rolled the stone off the mouth of the well, and wandered the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother. What phrase shows up three times in one pasuk?
Mother's brother.
Three times. Exactly, his mother's brother. Yaakov, Rashi explains to us, that Yaakov had run away from his family 14 years before this happened. There are 14 years of missing numbers. If you look at the, you do the math and the arithmetic, and Rashi figures it out for us. If you do the math, you see there are 14 years missing of his life. And the Midrash will say all different kinds of things. One of the interpretations is he was sitting and learning in yeshiva for 14 years. Notice that he did it before he got married. After he got married, he was working and supporting his family, but that's just a little side point, pet peeve of mine. So he's learning for 14 years in yeshiva before he gets married. 14 years he hasn't seen his family, and what comes popping straight into his head as soon as he sees Rachel three times in one pasuk, and who is Rachel?
His mother's
brother. You know, brings to mind that scene from The Frisco Kid. Any of you see The Frisco Kid, the movie with that, what's his name, Gene Wilder? He's a rabbi from, he plays a rabbi from Poland, and the people from San Francisco, it's like in the 1800s, they send a letter over saying that they're looking for a rabbi, and nobody wants to go to America in the middle of the 1800s, so they say, let's send him, he's like the dunce, you know, he's like ice skating when everybody's learning, whatever, so they send him across, and his tickets get stolen or whatever. It ends up he has to go cross country with, I think Harrison Ford plays a cowboy, and they go cross country mm-hmm. together. It's a hysterical, funny movie. Anyway, there's this scene where he wakes up and he realizes that all of his possessions are gone. And he wakes up and he starts davening. In the morning he puts on his talis, he puts on his tefillin, and then he's davening, and you hear him, and it turns out he's davening in an Amish farm. And an Amish guy is coming towards, you know, in their traditional garb, the black suit and the beard and the black hat. And he looks at them and he says, Lunchman, you know, family. Like, It's a funny scene, but this is exactly what Yaakov's saying. He looks at her and that's all he sees is his mother. And what is he here for? To continue his mother's legacy. Not to look for a replacement, but to look for a continuation of the values that his mother instilled in him. So here we come to our overhead projector. It's just going to take a moment. If I can turn it, we're going to turn it on. I haven't used this in quite a while. Okay. You see, I underlined for you, this is our section. I underlined for you three times in which this phrase, Achi Imo, his mother's brother, shows up. But I want to point something else out to you. Not only does he realize that he's continuing his mother's legacy, that he's found a family, but in his mother's, I don't know if you can see it, there you go. His mother, Rivka, when she tells Yaakov initially where he should go, where does she say? She should go to the house of Laban Achi. When Yitzchak tells Yaakov that he should go look for a wife, he tells, go to the house of Laban Achi Imecha, your mother's brother. And when the Torah tells us that Yaakov leaves his house and he's going towards the house of Laban, the son of Betuel Ha'arami, Achi Rivka, his mother's brother. So when he sees Rivka three times, we have here three times, Rivka to Yaakov, Yitzchak to Yaakov, the Torah telling us of Yaakov's journey, three times the phrase Achi Imo is written, and again we have down here, as soon as he sees her, again we have the three times of Achi Imo mentioned that he realizes now he can fulfill the commandments of his parents and the injunction that they told him to find a nice girl to marry. Cool, huh? Okay. I like those things. By the way, most of this year I didn't come up with on my own. I got it from a fabulous, fabulous book called Arba Imahot Ve'em Shamachot, which is the four mothers and the mother of the kingdom, referring to Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah, and Ruth. It's a book written by a rabbi in Israel named Rav Yudid, who teaches in Mechala in Yerushalayim. It's phenomenal. It's like fantastic. And I borrowed it from a friend of mine, from Tali Sobel, actually. She's here in town, and I photocopied the whole article on Rachel and Leah, because it's just, I mean, it was like 40 pages. It's just, and it's all in Hebrew, so it took me quite a while to get through it. It's so best when I'm sharing some of it with you, because it's just unbelievable but how to present it. Okay, so we have Yaakov meeting Rachel. He sees in Rachel a continuation of the legacy that his mother instilled in him and an opportunity to fulfill the commandments and the injunction that his parents told him that he should marry somebody from the family. Fine. Let's look at the first interaction now between them. Now we have we just now had the objective view. Now we have the interaction between the two of them. First thing he does, you know, lifts off that. All of a sudden has this, you know, huge power. He can lift off this stone all by himself. Okay, what is his reaction when he sees her? Immediately lifts off the stone, gives her to drink. Pasuk Yirav, the next pasuk, right after the one that I just read, Vayishak Yaakov Rachel, which is what you said. He kisses Rachel. Vayisa et kolo vayes. He lifts up his voice. And he cries. And if you look, oh, I didn't hand out my sheets to you. But when I hand them out to you, you can look at source number one. And you can see I forgot to underline the first word in the Hebrew, Vayashk, which means he gave to drink. Vayashk, source number one, Vayashk et sol lavan achimo, he gave to drink. Vayishak Yaakov Rachel, he kissed her. Vayishak kolo vayesh. And he lifted up his voice. And he broke into tears. He just broke down. He cried. Three elements of the meeting of the initial interaction between Yaakov and Rachel. We have the water, we have the kiss, and we have the cry. So what's going on? Says Rav Yudid, the water is indicative of the future success. Water is success. Water is life. Water is hope. Water is chesed, is giving. He's giving to her. He's giving her tzon, something to drink, giving her sheep, something to drink, water to drink. This indicates the future chesed and giving and hope of success that will be in Yaakov's household, because Yaakov in the end becomes very, very rich. That's the water. What about the kiss? Yaakov immediately connects with Rachel. They're soulmates. So, like, neshama to neshama. That's the kind of kiss that it was. But The Midrash says something very interesting in source number 2. Though why did he cry? What was he crying about? Lama bacha shera'ah anashim lachashim elu elu mipnei shenashka. He saw the other people who were standing around, the other shepherds, whispering to each other because he kissed her. They're like, what is this inappropriate, indecent guy coming in here for? We don't need to deal with any of this. And he was crying that they had the wrong understanding because it wasn't that kind of a kiss. It was a kiss where his neshama was talking to hers. He truly had a need and a desire to connect with her on a spiritual level. And that's what that kiss was, that connection. More than happy. He found his soulmate. And the Aramim, the people around him, the shepherds, didn't understand this deep connection, and that's why he cried. But the Midrash continues that he wasn't just crying for now. He was also crying for the future. Lama bacha shera'a she'ena nechneset imo l'kvura. He saw in an image that they were not going to be buried together. And this is what he cried. A spiritual connection between the two of them. And he said that this spiritual connection, well, physically, that the physical connection will not always be there, but they're not going to be buried next to each other. And indeed, this is truly what their relationship is all about. As we progress, you can see it's about the kiss, the deep connection, and the bechi, the crying, when he can't be with her, when he's not married to her first, when she dies in childbirth, when she's in so much pain. We don't see many interactions between Yaakov and Leah, but we see a discussion between Yaakov and Rachel that we're going to be talking about in 2 weeks, in which he expresses her pain at not being able to have children. And he's painful. He hurts for her. And this is what their relationship is all about, the kissing and the crying. Now, but something that was mentioned last week and something that I want to present to you also is that God is always controlling everything. God is always behind everything. Because you can say, what does he need this kind of relationship for? Because of the crying, but he also has the kiss. He also has the neshika. In source number 3, we have a midrash that's explained something that God is really has his finger in the whole thing. Hakol tzapoy lishmei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. God expects, he knows that whatever is going to happen. Kodim sheba Yaakov v'charan. Before Yaakov came to the area, Masa HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what did God do? Shalach magifa b'tzono shalavan v'nishtayru me'at me'harbei. Masha etar Rachel ro'ah. There was this huge plague that killed out almost all of Lavan's sheep. And he only had a small group of sheep left, and these are the ones that Rachel was shepherding. U'minayin sh'nishtayru me'at me'harbei. How do we know that only few were left from the many? Shenema, as it says later on, v'yakov ro'ah etzom avan hanotarot. That Yaakov, the Torah tells us, immediately after he comes to Laban's house, where are we? He says later on that Yaakov was the shepherd to the remaining sheep. So why would it say remaining sheep if there weren't tons of sheep that died beforehand? What's the point of this midrash? The point of the midrash is that God set everything up. He set up the need. Maybe Rachel was only a shepherdess. She was a woman. She wasn't as strong as a man, just by virtue of the fact that she was a woman. We can understand she probably wasn't as strong as a man. And usually men were shepherds. She was the only shepherdess in this whole group of men around the well. And it could be maybe she was only a shepherdess because there were only a few left, which means that she only would have met Yaakov because there were a few sheep left, that if there were many more sheep, that she wouldn't have been at the well, because she wouldn't have been involved. But because there were a few sheep left, maybe you can imagine Laban had to let go his regular shepherd, and Rachel was the one who took over. Fine. That's number one. Number two, God didn't only arrange the background of their meeting, he also arranged Yaakov's future in Laban's house. Because since there were few, then when Yaakov came to his house, then Yaakov made them be many, many sheep. And then he was blessed, and Laban was blessed, and then Laban felt favorably toward Yaakov and felt him as somebody he wanted to keep around. So God set everything up for him, explains the Midrash. So now here we have Yaakov comes, God sets it up so that he can find his soulmate, he can find his zivug. He together is going to be, she meets her, she is already a leader, and he is not yet a leader, she is a ro'ah. But then when he comes to Laban's house, now he is also going to be a shepherd. and together they're going to work. Now he's going to be a shepherd. Together now they're shepherds for 11 sheep. In the future, of course, we have the indication that they will be shepherds for the Jewish people and lead the Jewish people in the correct path. Okay. We have the background. We have the first impressions. You have the first encounter. Now we have the first conversation. What do you think, before we look at the pasuk, what do you think would be the first words out of Yaakov's mouth? I mean, we've all read romantic novels or seen romantic movies or something. What?
He wants to marry her.
What would be the first word out of his mouth to her, you think? He now knows he has found his soulmate, he's found his match, and he can't believe that he found her, something like that. Or, I can't believe I found you. You're more beautiful than I would have imagined, even though her beauty doesn't show up anywhere here. What else? I want to marry you.
Yeah. That's what he wants to
do. Wouldn't she be a little taken aback? I don't know, but yeah.
He knew that she was his mother's family. She didn't know that.
Okay.
So he tells her.
Okay. And that's exactly what he says to her, right? The next line after he kissed her, he cries, V'yage Yaakov l'Rachel, Pasuk Yud Bet, on page 148, 149, verse 12. Yaakov tells Rachel, Ki achia mihahu, that he is the brother of her father. V'chi ben Rivkahu, and that he's Rivka's son, V'taris v'tagid la'aviha, and she ran to tell her father. She's like a little bit excited, you know, she's running to tell her father, but notice she's running away from him a little bit, you know, who is this guy who's totally, you know, he kisses her and then he tells her who he is, all right, could be she was a little anxious about it, but the Midrash explained to us, so what exactly was Yaakov telling her? Two things here, number one, I am your father's relative, and number two, what's the second half of what he says, right here, I'm your father's brother, and he's Rivka's son. What does it tell Rachel about him that he's related to Lavan? What about Lavan? What's Lavan well known for? His best known quality? Not his best quality, but his best known quality. A trickster. Lavan Harama'i, the Midrash makes a play on the words of Arami, that he's from Aram, and splits the letters around. Harama'i, the trickster. Lavan's a trickster. He does the ultimate trick. The flip. Woohoo, I tricked you to marrying my other daughter. Wow, yay, he's a trickster, number one. So number one, he says, I'm related to Lavan. I can match wits with your father. I have a little bit of a trickster in me, which is why he then later on gives her the sign. But what else is he telling her? Who is he really? He could do it if he needs to, if he's in that position. But what is he really telling her? What's he really all about? Whose son is he? He's really Rivka's son, Rivka the tzaddikah, Rivka the righteous one. I'm really Rivka's son. That's really what I'm all about. So I want you to understand this about me, that I could match wits with your father if need be, but really deep down, I'm a pretty cool guy.
Now, are we assuming that she would have heard stories about Rivka and know something about Rivka?
Yes.
Just before CNN and everything.
It was before CNN, but first of all, they're all living in the Fertile Crescent, as we call it, which where there was a lot of trade going on back and forth. And you have to imagine that they would stay close with the families, and then she did hear stories about Rivka. I mean, Rivka and Yitzchak were leaders in the world. They were, you know, like the continuing the legacy of Abraham and Sarah. Everyone knew about Abraham and Sarah. They were promoting monotheism. So you have to expect that they would also know about Rivka and Yitzchak. Okay, what major character doesn't exist here? A major character in Yaakov's life is nowhere here in this story.
Yeah.
Exactly. Excuse me a moment. I have to run and get a tissue.
Leah,
who later on has this major, major role by giving birth to how many of the tribes? How many are there in total?
12.
So 6 out of 12 is?
Yeah.
Half. She gives birth to half of the future Jewish people. Where is she? He meets Rachel, has this immediate, strong spiritual connection between them, has a conversation with her, kisses her, she runs back to tell her father, and Leah is mentioned, like, later on. What happens? She runs back to tell her father, Pasuk Yud Gimel, the bottom of page 148, 149. So he hears about Yaakov, his relative, he runs to greet him, he hugs him, he kisses him, he brings him home, and Yaakov told him the whole spiel. Vayomer lo Lavan, Lavan says to him, Achas miu b'saviyata, you are my flesh and bones. Vayeshe bimo chodesh yamim, and he stayed with him for a month. Vayomer Lavan na Yaakov, Lavan says to Yaakov, hachi achiyata, v'adashem kinam, I know that you're my relative, but I can't make you work for free. Hagida limam maskor tacha, which implies that what was he doing from day one? He wasn't sitting around like a guest with his feet up and his arms crossed. He was working as soon as he got there. Right. So a month into it, Lavan wakes up and says, okay, what's your salary? And then we have, and Arshul, I have to give him credit here, puts this wonderful next pasuk in parentheses. We have a parenthetical comment that the Torah tells us. Lavan had two daughters. Ulavan shtei banot. Shein hagdola Leah. The bigger one was Leah. Literal translation, bigger, was Leah. And the smaller one was shein haktana Rachel. Leah's eyes were soft. The Rachel Hatayefatu Arvi Fatmaret, but Rachel was completely and totally beautiful. They have Yaakov and Rachel, Yaakov loves Rachel. Vayomer, he says, Evancha Sheva Shanim Rachel Bitcha Haktana, I will work for 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter.
So you had mentioned they were twins?
Yes.
So they had to be fraternal, not identical?
It could be. Yes. Or they could have been identical, because I'm about to suggest to you. The Midrash tells us, why was Leah's eyes so weak? Where are we? Okay, source 8. We like skipped a few things. But that's okay. Why were Leah's eyes so weak? On source number 8, if you look on line 7, Numahu Rakot, Rakot Nukhiya, that they were weak from crying. So it could be that they really were identical twins, but that Leah sort of ruined her appearance by crying. You know, that her eyes were tender and soft. So Leah doesn't show up here until a parenthetical reference later on. Now Ramban suggests, I have here in source number, by the way, source number four are the two things that he told her. I'm your father's relative and I'm Rivka's son. Source number 5 is the midrash that I mentioned that says I'm your father's son. I can trick with the best of them, but I'm also Rivka's son. I'm your father's relative, but I'm also Rivka's son, the tzaddik. But if you look around back on the next page, source number 6, on the other side, for she was a shepherdess, says Ramban. The intent of this is to relate that Lavan's sheep had no shepherd other than Rachel, since her father turned over the flock to her alone. She alone tended them all the days, and Leah did not go with the flock at all. The matter was thus unlike that of the daughters of Yitro, where all 7 daughters tended to the flock simultaneously. Perhaps due to Leah's eyes being tender, the rays of the sun would have hurt her, or because Leah was older and of marriageable age, her father was more concerned about her. So he gives a very practical, Ramban gives a very practical reason why Leah wasn't at the well, why Rachel was all by herself. It could be that Leah's eyes were too weak, it's after someone bothered her, so she couldn't be a shepherd. Or it could be that she, you know, she was of marriageable age and he couldn't compromise her. She had to busy her time learning embroidery and needlework and, you know, flirting with the guys and finding a...
Well, how much older is a twin going to be?
Right. So then if they're twins, well, that would clearly disagree with the Midrash that says that they were twins. Right. The point of the Midrash, I think, saying that they're twins supports the Midrash that says that Yaakov didn't recognize that Leah was Leah instead of Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
So they sort of work in tandem to each other. But one thing that we clearly have now, as much as the Torah focused on the fact that Rachel is a ro'ah, that she is a leader, Leah is not. And she may have a tremendous role, but she's not the shepherdess. Like, you know, and this is not her time to be with Yaakov. Later on she will, but not right now. So mentioned the daughters are mentioned in a sort of crass way, like as parentheses right after Laban asks Yaakov for what's your salary. They're, you know, they're mentioned there. And Leah is initially presented, we know two things about her. Is that how this is? Yeah. Source number 7. We learn two things about Leah immediately. The two things you know about Leah is Shem HaGadola Leah, that she's the older one.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing we learned, Be'eni Leah Rakot. She had weak or soft eyes. She's mentioned in comparison to Rachel. She's mentioned as a by the way. And she's also mentioned kind of negatively, again, as I mentioned before, whereas Rachel had her own introduction, Leah's only introduction is in connection to the salary that Yaakov is going to ask from Laban. So the question is, like, why is she presented in this particular way? And the Torah doesn't say that she is older. The Torah says, the word the Torah uses is gedola. She is bigger. She is larger. Not physically, but as the Midrash explains in source number 8, the end of line 1, gedola b'matnoteha. She had more gifts. She gave more things to the world than Rachel did. How? Aside from giving half of the 12 tribes, two of those were the biggies. One was Levi, who came from him all the priests who served in the Mishkan and the Beit HaMikdash. And two is Yehuda, who was the forebearer of all the kings. Forever and ever and ever. So she got the priesthood and the kingship, the spiritual leadership and the temporal leadership. She got the eternal gifts. Rachel Shaul, Rachel's descendant, Shaul is from the tribe of Binyamin, was the first king, but he was only for a short time. And really, the kingship really sits with Yehuda, with the tribe Yehuda. So that's the first thing that we know about Rachel, about Leah. There has to be something about her. She was able to give these eternal, everlasting gifts to the world of the priesthood, of the religious leadership, and the kingship, the temporal leadership. So why? Let's go back and revisit this idea of her crying. Mimi Leah Rakod, her eyes are soft, and it just explains because she cried. And we mentioned this last week, why was she crying? The Midrash continues and says, Shahayu Omrim, people would say, Kach Hayu HaTanayim, these are the conditions, HaGadola LaGadol VaHaKtana LaKatan, the oldest will go to the oldest, and the youngest will go to the youngest, meaning, she had heard a rumor that people were talking about that she was supposed to marry Esav, and that Rachel was supposed to marry Yaakov. She cried by Tabocha, she cried and cried and cried to God, but I'm married, and she said, I'm in line 8, the middle of line 8. Yiratzon, may it be God's will, shalo epol begoralo shel rasha, that I should not fall in the same category as this rasha, as this terribly evil man. And the Midrash continues, Amar Rav Huna, line 9, kashehi hatzvilah shebat lav hagzerah. How strong and how powerful is prayer that it nullified the decree. The decree initially for heaven was that Leah should marry Esav. But Leah davened so strong and so hard that not only was she able to erase the decree that she didn't have to marry Esav, she got to marry Yaakov and be a partner with him and Rachel in producing the Jewish nation. Like, how strong. So here we have a very strong quality of Leah. What's that?
Rachel must have been jealous of
her. You know, but Rachel had, they were both jealous of something. Rachel had all the love, Leah had all the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, you couldn't, God was giving a message, you can't have your cake and eat it too, clearly, you know, so they could have one or the other.
So Leah has some spiritual insight then.
Very strong spiritual insight. Mm-hmm. She's crying because her davening is so, so strong. So now we have these qualities of Leah. That she is the greater one. She gave greater gifts to the world. That she cries. She's sensitive, and it takes a lot to daven and cry when you daven. I mean, that's hard. You have to really mean it. You have to really believe it. And she did. And she davened. That's her third quality of hers, that she's so strong for davening. So now we have this question, okay. Originally, Yaakov was supposed to marry only Rachel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Leah, through her hard work and her davening, made it so that she was also a part in this partnership.
He married her.
What?
He married her first.
He married her too. Even he married her first,
mm-hmm.
right? We spoke about that God arranged for Rachel to marry Yaakov. That he set everything in motion, that he get, you know, you could say that he set the whole thing up with the tricking with Esav, so Yaakov would have to run away, and he made the plague so that Rachel would be shepherding the sheep, and that Yaakov would be necessary in Laban's house, and Yaakov would make Laban very rich, and then Laban would like him. So we have God, like, playing all the parts here. Now, really, and until this point in history, we've had one woman producing the next generation. Sarah had Yitzchak, Rivka had Yaakov. Rachel and Leah now are working together to produce the next generation. Is that really necessary? And the answer that I suggest to you, based on the sources that we've presented tonight, is yes. That both of them have qualities that are necessary for us to learn from. That Rachel was the leader from behind the scenes. That Rachel, though, was the destined one. She was the one who was supposed to marry him. But what about Leah? Leah was the hard worker. Leah was the one who, because she davened so strong to Hashem, and she had such a spiritual connection to God, and she davened and she worked hard, she got it also. So you have the two parts, and it's interesting because I've been seeing this happen, I've been seeing this come up in conversation a lot, particularly in the past 2 weeks. There are many, I mean, you know the movie. The movie. The Passion. You know, that's come out. And as you can imagine, it has been the topic of much conversation, particularly in my household, because my husband had the experience of watching it last week. He went with a group of rabbis, and he had a private screening of it. We also went to a different movie Saturday night and encountered the... I was so uncomfortable in this movie theater. I mean, they had like four showings of The Passion were sold out. Everyone assumed that my husband forgot to change from his Shabbos yarmulke. He wears a big white one on Shabbos, and he wears a darker colored one during the week. And he forgot to change, so he's wearing his big white one. And we're in this group of no one else recognizably Jewish, and everyone assuming that we were there to see The Passion. You know?
Did you?
No. No, thank you. And I have to say, I think that William Safire wrote a fantastic op-ed today in piece in the New York Times, excellent, about it, about the movie.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Say? You could read it. Oh. So go online if you get it online. Anyway, so the question is, like, how do you react to this movie? And many people in the yeshiva community are having the reaction that the answer to this is to say more Tehillim and do more mitzvahs, and that's how you combat anti-Semitism, by doing more mitzvahs and being better in your observance of the mitzvahs. And that's very nice and good. But I also have the privilege of being the only woman in sort of half attendance. My husband's Thursday night class. He has a Thursday night class for men in our home. On a book called Ein HaBanim Tznecha, a very interesting book, written by a guy in the time of the Holocaust, a rabbi. At the time of the Holocaust, a yeshivish rabbi, a black hat or whatever you want to call him, who became Zionist and realized at the time, and he writes this whole book of why you need to be Zionist, based on, like, he wrote the whole thing from memory, I think, from being in the concentration camp. Like, it's such an unbelievable mind that he had all these sources, Torah sources, why you have to be Zionist and moving to Israel and everything like that. And so they had a very heated discussion this past Thursday night. And the discussion, this debate was, like, okay, all these rabbis are saying, keep more mitzvot, daven more, say more Tehillim, and that's going to solve anti-Semitism. That's never solved anti-Semitism before. Not to say not to do it. Of course it's important. Not to say not to do the spiritual side. But you also have the working side. You also have the moving, you know, the Rabbi Sobel, the husband of the woman who I borrowed this book from, he's the head of the Kol Tor Mitzion, which we have in town, which is a Zionist kollel. There are Israelis who come to town for a few years. And he has been walking around saying, what are you talking about? You have to move to Israel. Everybody moves to Israel. You have to do something. You have to get up. You have to move. We have an Israeli army that is actually physically doing things to protect us in our land. But it's not only that. It's not only the actual physical, the fighting and the working. And it's not only the spirituality and the davening and the doing the mitzvot and the destiny. You know, we have this idea that Navi tells us, Yeshayahu tells us, that God said he will bring the geula, the redemption, at its time, I will hurry it up. And the commentaries go, nuts. What do you mean at its time, I'll hurry it up? Which one is it? And the idea is that there is a set time, maybe, when it's going to happen. But we can make it happen sooner if we do things. There's a concept of the destiny. There's a concept of the Rachel. That certain things are supposed to happen. But what about the hard work? And the hard work isn't only davening. And davening is an important hard work, but it's not only davening. It's the doing. It's the supporting. It's the, you know, all of that stuff. The actual doing. We can't just sit in our yeshivas and sit in our homes with our sidurim and our chumashim and our Torah and expect that everything's going to get better. But it's also not going to get better if all we do is move to Israel and fight. You need both of them together, to work together. We need the Rachel, the destiny, and we also need the lay of the hard work. And together, they create Am Israel, the Jewish nation.
Wow.